Judges chapter 6, beginning in verse 25, and I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. That night the Lord said to him, Gideon, take your father's bull, the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father, and cut down the sacred pole that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold here, in proper order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the sacred pole that you shall cut down. So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the townspeople to do it by day, he did it by night. When the townspeople rose early in the morning, the altar of Baal was broken down and the sacred pole beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. So they said to one another, "Who has done this?" After searching and inquiring, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did it." Then the townspeople said to Joash, "Bring out your son so that he may die, for he's pulled down the altar of Baal and cut down the sacred pole beside it." But Joash said to all who were arrayed against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you defend his cause? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been pulled down." Therefore on that day Gideon was called Jerubbaal, that is to say, "Let Baal contend against him, because he pulled down his altar." The title of the sermon today is an odd one, and I struggled over whether or not it was appropriate, but the title is Tashlan. It's not Hebrew, it's not Greek, but if you're familiar at all with C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia, it's a character from the last book, The Last Battle. Tashlan. So this is from C.S. Lewis's The Final Battle. "Please, please," said the high voice of a woolly lamb, who was so young that everyone was surprised he dared to speak at all. "What is it now?" said the ape. "Be quick." "Please," said the lamb, "I can't understand. What have we to do with the Calormenes? We belong to Aslan. They belong to Tosh. They have a god called Tosh. They say he has four arms and the head of a vulture. They kill men on his altar. I don't believe there's any such person as Tosh, but if there was, how could Aslan be friends with him?" All the animals cocked their heads sideways, and all their bright eyes flashed toward the ape. They knew it was the best question anyone had asked yet. The ape jumped up and spat at the lamb. "Baby," he hissed, "silly little bleater. Go home to your mother and drink milk. What do you understand of such things? But the others, listen. Tosh is only another name for Aslan. All that old idea of us being right and the Calormenes wrong is silly. We know better now. The Calormenes use different words, but we all mean the same thing. Tosh and Aslan are only two different names for you-know-who. That's why there can never be any quarrel between them. Get that into your heads, you stupid brutes. Tosh is Aslan. Aslan is Tosh." You know how sad your own dog's face can look sometimes? Think of that. And then think of all the faces of those talking beasts. All those honest, humble, bewildered birds, bears, badgers, rabbits, moles, and mice. All far sadder than that. Every tail was down, every whisker drooped. It would have broken your heart with very pity to see their faces. There was only one who did not look at all unhappy. It was a ginger cat, a great big Tom in the prime of life, who sat bolt upright with his tail curled round his toes, in the very front row of all the beasts. He had been staring hard at the ape and the Calormene captain all the time and had never once blinked his eyes. "Excuse me," said the cat very politely, "but this interests me. Does your friend from Calormene say the same?" "Assuredly," said the Calormene, "the enlightened ape, man I mean, is in the right. Aslan means neither less nor more than Tosh." "Especially Aslan means no more than Tosh?" suggested the cat. "No more at all," said the Calormene, looking the cat straight in the face. There's a fine line between worshiping the God of all creation in personal, authentic ways, and between that and worshiping a false god. This is the space that C.S. Lewis was exploring. How do we distinguish between the gods of the nations and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? How does our worship need to reveal the God to whom we pray? There's a fine line between these things, and it's a line that Israel throughout her history had great difficulty in drawing. We're going to look at Israel's practice, religious practice today in the life of Gideon. And we're going to do that in three sort of stages. And my hope is that in the course of this conversation, we will begin to begin maybe the conversation about whether or not we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who became flesh in the person of Jesus, or whether we worship another God. It's going to be a tough sermon for that reason, but it was tough for Gideon, and it should be no easier for us. So the three stages of Israel's religious practice we're going to talk about is first conflation. We've already been talking about that. When the multiple gods and value systems begin to merge into one almost indistinguishable new worship. Conflation. The second is going to be conflagration. How does God respond to structures built with that kind of conflation? And then finally, reconstruction. What does it mean in the rubble of what God does to rebuild again the worship of the one true God? So look at chapter 6, verse 25 again. That night the Lord said to him, take your father's bull, the second bull, 7 years old, pull down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father. Pull down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father. So this belonged to his father. And they have a shrine to Baal where they worshipped him and an Asherah pole, a wooden stick that was used to worship the goddess, Baal's consort. And it belonged to his dad. So he says, tear it down. And then when we move down into verse 29, we find out what his father's name was. Gideon's father's name was Joash. Joash means Yahweh has given. So we're living in a time in which the guy who runs the temple of Baal in the tribe of Manasseh is named Yahweh has given. These, among other details, have led many theologians to conclude that the Israelites came to see Yahweh and Baal as two sides of the same coin, as indistinguishable deities, one coming from the Canaanites, the other coming from the Israelites, but more or less still the same God. Trent Butler, in his commentary on Judges, has written, people worship Baal and Yahweh together indiscriminately, either merging the two deities into one or allotting each deity controls and thus reason to be worshipped over various segments of daily and personal life. So we have a situation in Israel where they've come into a land that's filled with other value systems and other gods and other ways of doing life and other ways of bringing in harvest and other ways of giving thanks. And they've come into that land, they've lived among the people, and they've not remained separate. Over time, the religion of Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the religion of Baal have begun to merge to the point that a priest could be named after Yahweh and lead the people in worshiping Baal and Asherah. And this seems to have been no problem for them. It's a story that is recurrent through the history of the people of Israel. And it is with us today. Today we call the conflation pluralism. What we must remember, church, is that though we are to be gracious with those with whom we disagree, though we are to be people who are slow to become angry and quick to forgive, we do submit ourselves to the belief that the knowledge of the God of all creation has been revealed to us through specific revelation. The revelation of the prophets of Israel and of the apostles of Jesus. But I don't think it's good logic to argue that because there's only one God, everyone must be worshiping him. Just in different ways. For the Israelites, and this is a lesson that Gideon had to learn the hard way, and Israel over its whole history had to learn the hard way, to worship the one God in ways apart from those ways he gave us to worship him is idolatry. We are not determined to be faithful based on the name of the God we worship. Our faithfulness is dependent on the manner in which we worship him. Conflation, where all the belief systems of the nations become one amorphous religious expression. Tashlan is the God that results from the bringing together of all the value systems of the world into one religious expression. It's what was happening in Israel. It's why God judged them over and over and over again. I still do not understand why we think we will avoid his judgment if we do the same. So God's response to all this in the life of Gideon, we find again in verse 25 through 27. This is what God told him to do. The second point is conflagration. That night the Lord said to him, take your father's bull, the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father, and cut down the sacred pole that's beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold here. In proper order. Do it according to the Torah. Build that altar the way I told you to build it. And then take all the other stuff you built to worship me, put it on that altar, and burn it. That's what he told Gideon to do. And so Gideon did it. Of course, he did it at night because he was afraid. We talked about Gideon's character in the last sermon. He is quite a squirrely character. He gets nervous easy. So he does this. He obeys, but he does it overnight and not in front of everybody. Over and over again, both in Judges and in the history of Israel, the religion reaches a critical turning point in which the other religions that they've begun to co-opt and merge into the worship of God become indecipherable. There's almost no way anymore to pull them apart. That critical moment in which the worship of Yahweh and the worship of other gods, loyalty to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and loyalty to other values and other systems of belief can no longer be disentangled. The extra canonical elements, the things outside of the instructions of the prophets and the apostles, have been so intertwined with their teachings that they can no longer be redeemed or refashioned. The only thing that can happen is that they have to be torn down and put on a new altar and burned. It seems that the Israelites reached that point here. There was no turning back. They were going to be idol worshipers. There was no going back to Yahwehism without tearing down the poles and starting over. And God says to Gideon, tear him down and burn him on an altar you built according to my specifications. In our context, extra-biblical values and sensibilities have even co-opted the very definitions of words. What the scriptures mean by love is not what we mean by love, and yet we use our definition to interpret them. What the scriptures mean by hate is not what we mean by hate, and yes, we use our definition to interpret them. Even the very language we use to talk about our faith is merging with other value systems. What's needed, I think, as was true in Israel, is somehow a tearing down of corrupted structures. And I think this is being forced on us in many ways. I have a sense today that the Christendom, what we used to call Christendom, the religion of Christianity, united with the state, in power, making decisions, having influence, I think it's God who's tearing it down. I think for our corruption, our merging of pagan beliefs with Christian beliefs, our inability to separate what it means to be a godly people from what it means to be an American people, what it means to be a safe people from what it means to be a sacrificed people. I think we built structures that were so corrupted that they're being torn down. I think the towers of Baal have to come down and have to go back on the altar and be burned, and you and I are not going to get to choose to do it. It's being done for us. That's what I think. So conflation happens and then conflagration. You must tear down the structure and then finally reconstruction. And I love these little details in the story. God is giving Gideon some little bits of advice on how the new religion of Israel, which is really the old religion of Israel, needs to look. The first is no more poles. There's no way to sanctify the pole. You can't say, well, I know that God didn't talk about setting up poles, but we find the pole to be really meaningful. We find it to be very helpful to us to dance around that pole. And so I know he didn't tell us to do it, but there's a sacred way to dance around the pole. Certainly we can be Yahweh worshipers and use the pole that they used to use for Ashtoreth. Isn't that just redeeming the culture? And he says, no more poles. No more shrines. And then he tells them what he wants next. Build an altar, he says in verse 26. In proper order. Go back to the law you have forsaken. Stop building with your gut and start building by the designs I gave you. And then in verse 31, Joash, the priest of Baal, makes the distinction that has to be made forever. But Joash said to all who were arrayed against him, will you contend for Baal or will you defend his cause? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he's a god, let him contend for himself because his altar has been pulled down. And so Joash, the priest of Baal, finally makes the distinction that Israel refused to make. There's no more saying Baal and Yahweh are the same. We're done. They're different. Whoever contends for Baal is an enemy of Yahweh. To reconstruct, we have to go back. The renewal history of Israel always involved, over and over and over again, a return to Torah, a return to the law of Moses. And the renewal history of Christianity has been the same. From the early ecumenical councils of the church where they debated heresy, to the Protestant Reformation, to the rise of evangelical Christianity in the 20th century, to whatever will arise out of the current climate. In times of renewal, the faithful have always returned to the prophets of Israel and the apostles of Jesus. And they have begun to build again. The Bible, I think, is similar to a set of building codes. It's not exactly that. It's not just laws and principles, though it certainly does include those things. It's also a foundational history filled with narratives and prayers and songs and teachings. But essentially for Christians, whatever we build in God's name has to be built within the limits demarcated in the scriptures. These are the codes. In Gideon's time, Israel needed to go back to the blueprints. They had to go back to the building codes and ask themselves again, what did we build and is it safe? Aslan and Tosh had become Toshlan. Perhaps we need a reset as well. Sometimes the faithful let it burn. And if we don't choose to do it, it's going to happen anyway. God tears stuff down that he doesn't like. All the time, throughout history, every nation, every church, every building, everything. Just whatever he wants. And the faithful go back to factory settings. They look again at the scriptures and they say, let's build again. Let's build in the rubble.